From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later today, President Trump will unveil the new Republican tax plan in a speech in Indianapolis. There hasn't been a tax overhaul since 1986, but his administration is hoping for a win here after two big losses. Republicans had to pull back their latest plan to repeal and replace Obamacare for lack of votes. And Luther Strange, the candidate supported by both the president and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the primary runoff in Alabama, lost. NPR's lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
And it was Roy Moore who won in Alabama. He was twice removed from his job on the state Supreme Court because he refused to remove a statue of the Ten Commandments and refused to issue licenses for same-sex marriage. So he wins. But is this really a big loss for President Trump? Because it seemed obvious that he wasn't wholeheartedly backing Luther Strange. He launched the NFL kneeling controversy in the middle of a rally there in Alabama. He said he might have made a mistake. So does this stick?
And certainly that comment of making a mistake was something that Roy Moore was actually able to use in an ad, saying, look, hey, I'm on President Trump's team anyway. And you saw the president try to delete some of his tweets last night, or at least someone on his staff, trying to show, look, we'll be on board with Roy Moore.
So tweets supporting Luther Strange.
Strange. Right. Yep. But the thing is with this, it's like, you know, I think what it's going to have an impact on is conservatives who feel like they can now be emboldened with Steve Bannon, the head of Breitbart. You know, he's somebody who maybe would have felt like, all right, the president wins out in his brand, but if Strange were to win, but that didn't happen. In fact, it wound up being Moore as the winner, and conservative base had backed him, and President Trump apparently doesn't have maybe what he had thought was a hypnotic effect on his base.
Right, or he didn't do the hypnosis as fully as he might have if he really believed it. And do we presume Moore will be the Democrat in the elections when they come in Alabama? And does his win mean that others of the more conservative right-wing mindset will follow and run? What is this all meaning for the Republican Party in the mix in Congress?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats think they might have an outside chance of taking on Moore, but the likelihood in a place where Donald Trump's approval rating is in the low 80s, that a Democrat would really have a chance is still a very far long shot, and no doubt that Moore will be the favorite to be the next senator from Alabama. And I do think that this will embolden primary challengers, and it will make incumbents in Congress, in the Senate, sort of maybe think about whether or not they want to continue on. If they were thinking about retirement, that might be something they think about more. And it could mean more money that they have to spend to hold off these primary challengers.
Yeah. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee formally announced he won't run for re-election yesterday. I want to move on to the other big defeat for Republicans, the Obamacare repeal, not enough votes. How big a loss is this?
It's a huge loss. And just look at the 90-degree turn that they took in just talking about health care, talking about the tax overhaul, which they've now said essentially, yeah, maybe that'll come back, but we're all about taxes, and this is what conservatives do. Conservatives do taxes. But the health care loss was a huge loss for Republicans, for Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, who still retains a deep reservoir of goodwill among his caucus, but a really bad week for him. I mean, he loses this healthcare effort. He had backed Luther Strange. Luther Strange was his handpicked candidate for that Alabama race, somebody he had known for some time. And also today, he's a big Louisville booster. Rick Pitino, the head basketball coach there, was just fired from his job because of that NCAA scandal. So a really bad week for Mitch McConnell all around.
There you go. I want to ask, it's a horrible week in Puerto Rico. And just your thoughts, Domenico, on how history will view, and of course, we're not there yet at history, but how it will view President Trump's handling of the Puerto Rico crisis. We saw, the Twitter storm begging him to do more and get off the NFL topic. Hillary Clinton was tweeting, send the military hospital ship the Comfort. The administration finally is, but it won't get there for 5 to 7 days. Your thoughts?
And President Trump said that he's getting very good marks for their response to Puerto Rico. The administration should probably learn from past administrations that when it comes to hurricane recovery or disaster recovery, it's never good to toot your own horn and to do it, especially in just the days following something that's, you know, a disaster where people still don't have power, don't have running water, and are still having a very difficult time. The priority should be focusing on how to get those people and those infrastructure pieces back up and running. And today you saw the administration try to show that it cared a little bit more about the optics of it anyway by having TV hits where you see the assistant FEMA director and a bunch of people behind them seemingly working, you know, and that may seem like a superficial point. But when you talk about your priorities, when President Trump over the weekend seemed to be more concerned about sports and not tweeting at all about Puerto Rico until Monday night after he'd taken some criticism for that, it is a matter of optics, but it's a matter of priorities, and it makes people question and wonder whether or not his priorities are on the people of Puerto Rico and this long-term disaster recovery.
Yeah. NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much, Robin.
And as the humanitarian disaster continues to unfold in Puerto Rico, about 97% of the island's residents still have no power. It's also very difficult for Puerto Ricans on the mainland to reach their loved ones on the island by phone. Angelique Sina is executive director of the nonprofit Friends of Puerto Rico. She joins us from New York, a state that is home to 1.2 million Puerto Ricans. Angelique, we've been hearing stories from Puerto Ricans here on the mainland having trouble getting in touch with their loved ones there. What have you been hearing?
Jeremy, people are desperate, right? Because there is nothing worse than you not being able to reach your families. And the fact that the island has lost 100% of electricity means that signals, you know, phone companies are not able to establish antennas for communication. So it has been really hard in each and every one of us because we all have either our immediate or extended family on the island. And many, many families have not been able to communicate.
Have you been able to reach your family there?
I was able to reach my father through a family member that borrowed a phone. Hmm. So it's not even the fact of being able to talk to him still, you know, causes anxiety. There is a big movement to try to travel to the island, but that is somewhat restricted still. So the recommendation that the government is giving to wait, you know, 1 to 2 weeks until, you know, commercial flights will be, you know, able to fly into the island.
How do you feel about the government's response to the storm in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, I believe the government is doing the best they can, given that Puerto Rico is an island, right? And it's something that still, you know, being all Americans, it's something difficult to understand because the storm has hit the island so bad. But then the geographical location limits the resources that you have. You know, you can't put things in a truck. I believe FEMA is doing the best it can. The fact that we have more Puerto Ricans, right, even though we're not a it's not an official nationality, on the mainland than on the island also causes a lot of buzz, right, to label it like that because we're also eager to help, but that we're limited because we have an ocean, you know, between our loved ones.
Do you think that a lot of Puerto Ricans will stay after this or that they're going to come and live in New York or Miami or somewhere in the U.S. mainland?
The level of poverty that the island has, you know, at least 65% of the island had already a poverty rate before the hurricane hit. And the fact that thousands and thousands of families have lost all of their homes or businesses, the fields they used to grow coconuts and plantains, most of them didn't have insurance just because they probably couldn't afford insurance. So a lot of them will just take, you know, a plane to the mainland and, yes, move to Florida, New York. Migration rates have already steadily increased throughout the years to the economic recession. So I believe that many of them will be coming to the other states.
President Trump, as you know, pointed out in some tweets that Puerto Rico, you know, was in terrible shape even before these hurricanes with infrastructure problems and economic problems, a lot of debt. But what did you think of the president's comments about Puerto Rico that seemed to imply that in a way it's their fault that they're in such bad shape right now?
Well, that is a very complex question. I don't want to say that it's the fault of the people from Puerto Rico. I feel that there are many things, you know, that come from the U.S. Congress level, such as the Jones Act, that really limit the economic growth of the island. There's so many aspects of what happened to the economy. Why did that bubble burst? Why people have migrated in such a particular situation in comparison to any of the United States?
What would your message be to people in Puerto Rico right now, if you could reach them, which obviously you can't?
Yes. If I could reach them, I would tell them, you know, to try to remain calm in the extent that it is possible. The diaspora, me, you know, since I've moved from the island 7 years ago, there's so many members of the diaspora like me that are so eager to help, to provide aid and relief. It just will take longer than we would want to. I know the island will get back on track. Don't think that Puerto Rico is, you know, destroyed. Let's think that it is closed for renovations.
That's Angelique Cena, who is executive director and co-founder of the nonprofit Friends of Puerto Rico, joining us from New York. Angelique, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Want to start an argument? Just bring up the use of cell phones in schools. According to some research, up to 70% of U.S. schools that had banned cell phones are now reversing those bans, saying they're giving into the fact that the bans didn't work anyway, or they're claiming that cell phones can be a teaching tool. Pushing back from the other side, bans. Schools that say kids are obsessed with distracting phones. A father of five is leading a Colorado ballot initiative to ban all cell phone sales to kids under the age of 13 after he tried to take his son's phone away and was stunned at the boy's violent reaction. But should cell phones be banned from schools? Let's start with a no. New York City is the largest school district in the country. It recently reversed a ban instituted under the Bloomberg administration. Current mayor Bill de Blasio says phones are a critical way for parents to reach kids. They also provide opportunity. Jose Vilson agrees. He teaches middle school math in Washington Heights. Jose, you say no ban. Why?
I'd say no ban for the specific reason that, you know, this debate reminds me a lot of sex ed, where if you think about the ways that people keep saying, oh, we have to be absent, 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 and all the while, kids feel that pressure, right, to not have to do it. But then once they feel the pressure, they also feel the pressure to rebel. And so instead of trying to push it out of our schools, why don't we make it an integral part of our schools and have kids be more responsible with it? And why not make those tools that they have in their pockets into tools for learning? And oftentimes I find that when we teach children not to do something, when they become adults, they have a harder time actually using it in a responsible way.
Well, this is what I'm hearing in a school that I'm involved with. But isn't that sort of like saying, let's put lollipops out in front of three-year-olds and teach them the responsibility of not eating too many lollipops? I mean, it's very, very hard to ask teens, especially teens with, you know, maybe attention deficit disorders or compulsive behavior anyway. You know, 50% of teens in some surveys say we are addicted to our cell phones. Isn't asking them to be responsible maybe just, you know, asking for trouble?
I would say no for the specific reason that there's a whole ton of arguments to be made for saying that we should ban every single thing. There has to be a point where we as a country take some responsibility for the cultural norms that we establish. And if we're introducing cell phones, then we're basically saying, okay, this is something that you may be addicted to at some point, but we're going to teach you how to use it responsibly so you can pull back a bit. Mm-hmm. It's a lot like healthy eating. It's a lot like the other things that we have out there that perhaps are perilous if we don't set some sort of standard or at least have a sense sense of saying, let's have a conversation around this instead of trying to say it doesn't exist.
Well, what about some of the bans, and we're going to hear about one, in fact, are because phones are used for bullying. They're used for cheating. We mentioned distractions. But also, they are a sign of a huge inequity in this country. You know, maybe some kids can afford a cell phone and some can't.
Well, we do that with almost everything. I mean, when it comes to school clothing, for example, the kids end up picking up these social cues of who has more money, who doesn't, based on sneakers, based on
backpacks,
their social activities. So it's the same thing with cell phones. And unfortunately, the other part of the inequity argument is, what about high schools that have metal detectors, for example, which I think is an argument that New York City Mayor de Blasio also says, which is there's too many of our schools that when they have metal detectors and our kids have their cell phones in their pockets, they're either asked to store them outside or they're being screened, but they're being late to class. Those places that have metal detectors end up being in spaces with poor black and brown kids.
So that's what de Blasio means when he says opportunity, because, in fact, there's a phenomenon. There are phone trucks that park outside these schools where kids go and sort of rent charging. They have to pay to have it charged while they go in the school. And he says this is, you know, reducing their opportunity. Do you see the cell phones being used really as tools?
As a matter of fact, yes. Here's what I'd say. I mean, in my own classroom, I teach my kids to be responsible. And this is the way I do it. First, I pull out my cell phone. I say, look, this is a device that I have. And if you ever hear it go off, you're going to see me pull it out and then turn it off and then put it back in my pocket. And I advise everybody to be responsible in that way. And so far, it's worked pretty well. For 99% of the kids, I haven't had to take a cell phone away in the last 4 or 5 years. Then there was the other part where, okay, we may have iPads, we may have laptops, and we're able to get that because of the school that I'm in, and I'm blessed for that. But there are times when the Wi-Fi won't work or the internet won't work. And so, of course, we have these cell phones like, okay, well, why don't you look up this and tell me what you think? And once you use that cell phone as saying, look it up, you can go ahead and do that. That creates a sense of student agency that they normally wouldn't have.
That's Jose Luis Vilson. He teaches middle school math in Washington Heights, New York. His book is This Is Not a Test, A New Narrative on Race, Class, and the Future of Education. He's against bans on cell phones in schools. Jose, Mr. Vilson, thank you so much.
And thank you. I appreciate this.
Let's now bring in Jana Mates. She's the principal of Lewiston Middle School in Lewiston, Maine, where a ban was instituted for this new school year. Principal Mates, why'd you do it?
Mostly in response to the overwhelming amount of negative use of social media. A lot of the office referrals, a lot of the talk in the community all revolved around conversations that we're having on social media, and some of them during the school day. And I just feel like it's too much pressure for a kid. They're here to learn. They're here for structure. They're here to focus on being a kid, and that wasn't happening.
So how's it going?
We were pretty transparent about the change in this policy and why we were doing it right from the beginning. We put it right in our list of middle school policy handbook. We put it on the website. And then the first 2 days of school, we pulled kids down into the auditorium and we just told them why. I think if kids understand where you're coming from and that, you know, it's not to be mean or to put more rules in place, but because we genuinely care about them, it's actually been a really positive outcome. I think kids are actually getting it, and the pressure of not having to worry about what's happening on social media during the day is almost like a weight off their shoulders that they didn't anticipate what was going to happen.
Well, you talk about how this had become a problem. Were you finding what I'm hearing anecdotally that, you know, teachers couldn't even get kids to give up their phones, which is alarming?
Here, not using cell phones has always been a suggested practice, but what was happening is kids were, you know, going to the bathroom 10 times more than they should so that they could go use it, or they were late to class because they were in the hall texting or on social media, and those pieces have been taken away. And so there's been a handful of times where we've had to, you know, our policy is the first time it's warning, second time the phone gets taken away until the end of the day, third time a parent has to pick it up, and we've yet got to get to the point where a parent has to come pick up the phone.
Well, am I actually hearing that being kids are using the bathroom less in your school?
Correct.
<Yes. laughs>
They're actually using the bathroom only when they need to go to the bathroom.
Well, but this is a middle school. These aren't kids who maybe have become as hardwired to their phones as high schoolers are. Is this part of maybe stopping that before it happens?
I mean, we've coupled our cell phone ban policy along with some relationship building, some restorative practices. We start every single morning with an academic seminar in which teachers do a circle. Kids sit in a circle face-to-face, eye contact. They talk about what's going on their day, issues, problems. That time is extended on Monday, Friday. So yeah, we get it. There is the value of in-person conversations has to be a focus here.
Kids are texting themselves on their cell phones when they're sitting right next to each other.
Not anymore.
No, right. Not at your school. Well, we have to touch on the fact that there was another impetus for this. There was a suicide. Was it tied to bullying by a cell phone, or was the reaction to the suicide, you know, inappropriate on cell phones? What's the connection?
The suicide itself was not tied to bullying, but the reaction to the suicide, there was a lot of negative statements and comments and just outrage via social media, kids, you know, being brought into things and exposed to things that they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, so there is that. But what about what we've just been hearing, that having a cell phone in the classroom teaches kids responsibility? Once you ban something, then you leave them incapable of maturing and taking responsibility for it. Or once you ban it, they want it more. Or it can be used as a teaching tool, and these kids won't know how to do that.
Well, I mean, I think there are age limits on lots of things in life for a reason. We have computers here for students. Anything that they need to go on educationally, they're able to via MacBooks. And I don't know. I think in our society, is it really our job to teach kids how to use Facebook when you know, 50% of our school isn't reading on grade level?
Yeah. How do parents react? Because we're hearing from Mayor de Blasio in New York that parents want to be able to reach kids on phones.
I don't know about you, but when I was in school, my parents could still reach me. I mean, we called the main office, and if for inclement weather there's a practice canceled or a change in plans after school, every single classroom has a landline, and teachers are more than happy to let students call their parents. And I can already, in the 4 weeks that we've been here, see a difference in the morale and the relationships that teachers and students have.
Hmm. Lewiston, Maine middle school principal Jana Mates, their school instituted a cell phone ban, and she says it's going pretty well. Principal Mates, thank you.
Thank you.
So your thoughts. Are cell phones a way of teaching kids responsibility, or are they a way to make sure that certain kids in particular are doomed to distraction and failure? This is World War III in many classrooms, so we'd love to hear your thoughts and solutions.
President Trump is in Indianapolis today to promote the Republican plan for a tax overhaul. Some details of that plan are already out. It includes big changes to the rates for individuals and corporations, as well as a reduction in the number of tax brackets. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And let's start with the corporate tax rate. It looks like the plan is to cut the rate from 35% down to 20%.
Yes, and this has really been an interesting argument, because a lot of folks have been saying, oh gosh, 35, it's so much higher than the rest of the world. But, you know, when you look at all the different loopholes that are in the corporate tax code, it's been argued that actually the effective rate for most U.S. companies is closer to, say, 24%. That gets us closer to about 21, 22% for the rest of the world. That said, I think on both sides of the aisle, people think, wow, our corporate tax code's kind of wacky. We need to actually streamline it. So we'll see. Again, there are very few details on this part of it, and I think that that's going to be the real tough part in the negotiation, is finding out what these details are and then seeing who's willing to go in on it.
Well, what do we know about the individual tax rate? It looks like we're expecting a cut for the wealthiest Americans.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting because when the president had released that one-page document earlier in the year and saying, here's my wish list, he talked about there being three specific tax brackets. Then it was 10, 25, 35. In this plan, it looks like there's three brackets, 12%, 25%, and 35%, with maybe a little bonus. Maybe there'll be a fourth one, but we don't know that. They said maybe for high-income folks. Here's what's interesting. There's no detailed breakdown of the income levels to which these new rates apply. So we don't really know how that's going to affect whomever is involved in this. But it seems to me that that's a pretty big missing link here.
And that bottom rate, you said 12%, that would actually be an increase for the poorest, right?
That's exactly right. And to compensate for that, the plan would actually increase the standard deduction. It would go to $24,000 for married taxpayers filing jointly. It's currently $12,700. And it would go to $12,000 for single filers, up from $6,350. So obviously, if you increase that standard deduction, that would mean that fewer people would pay taxes on the amount up to those limits. And I think that's the way that they kind of split the difference between the 10 and the 12.
I assume nobody is talking about changes to the mortgage interest deduction, one of the most popular deductions out there.
Yes, and I think that it's interesting that the two areas where there's really clear intent here is mortgage interest as well as charitable contributions, both of which should remain deductible. But here's what doesn't look like made of the cut. State and local taxes being deductible. Now, if you're in a high tax state, California, New York, New Jersey, this is going to be bad news for you because right now you are able to deduct your state and local taxes. Not surprisingly, many of the voters in those states did not vote for President Trump.
Well, and by the way, I learned that they call that the SALT deduction, state and local taxes deduction. Any chance this gets through?
Well, look, not as is, and there's no details here, and we don't know how much it's going to cost, which is a pretty major league point of contention. I should also note one other thing, that this is obviously the opening shot, so
right.
Everyone's going to weigh in, and remember, lobbyists on both sides of every tax issue. This is going to be a long and thorny process.
And I saw one senator say today it's going to make healthcare look like a piece of cake. Jill Schlesinger with CBS News, thank you.
Take care.
As we continue to follow the aftermath of Hurricanes Irma and Maria, we're learning a lot about the Caribbean, once a crossroads of trade and colonialism, now a center for tourism. Joining us now for more on the history is Ernesto Bossi, an assistant professor of history at Cornell University. He's with us on Skype from Sevilla, Spain. Ernesto, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's go back to the beginning, if you will, the beginning at least of human civilization in the Caribbean. There were indigenous tribes in places, right?
Yes, and for that story, we can go back about 7,000 years when the first humans entered the Caribbean islands, right? They entered from northeastern South America, from Venezuela through Trinidad. The standard account speaks of two groups, the Caribs and the Arawaks, or the Caribs and the Taínos. Supposedly, the Caribs were chasing the Taínos. The Taínos, by the time of the arrival of the Spaniards, were settled in the larger islands of Cuba, Jamaica, and Hispaniola, which today is Santo Domingo, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti. The Caribs were sort of settled in what are called now the Lesser Antilles, the small chain of islands east of Puerto Rico, south to the coast of Venezuela. So at the time of the arrival of the Spaniards, these two groups are in conflict, and of course the consequences of the encounter or the arrival of the Spaniards can be described as a sort of cataclysmic collapse. Because of both slavery and disease, the introduction of new diseases from Europe to the Americas to the Caribbean played definitely a huge role in the near complete extinction of the indigenous populations of the Caribbean.
So that was the arrival of the Spanish, but other European countries also came to the Caribbean and claimed their own territory. When did that happen?
shortly after the arrival of the Spaniards arrived, as we all know, in 1492, then the Spaniards are sort of establishing a basis in the Caribbean, looking for wealth. There is not much in the form of precious metals in the Caribbean. In places like today's Peru and Mexico, the Spaniards actually found precious metals in great amounts, which led them to sort of abandon huge chunks of the Caribbean. Actually, they called these smaller islands the Islas Inútiles, the useless islands, which some historians have interpreted as meaning that they were useless or less useful to Spaniards because there were no riches to be exploited in these islands.
But they certainly exploited the people with slavery.
Definitely. And there were slave raids to these smaller islands from which indigenous slaves were taken not only to the larger islands like Cuba, but also to the continent. But in the aftermath of this Spanish turn to the continent, a number of smaller islands were left semi-abandoned, and they offered a good entry point for other Europeans, like the English, like the Dutch, like the French, who first entered the Caribbean as pirates, basically, right? These other European empires, these other European powers gradually shifted to agriculture. Sugar, which came to the Americas with Columbus, slowly, gradually emerged as the main crop to be produced in the Caribbean. And the rise of sugar is very much associated with the massive introduction of enslaved populations from Africa.
How did the United States end up with territory in the Caribbean?
After the U.S. becomes independent, the idea of the U.S. Westward expansion, there was a chance for this U.S. expansion to have taken place towards the Caribbean. Talk of annexing Cuba was constant and somewhat important during the 19th century U.S. Actually, towards the end of the 19th century, when Cuba becomes independent, it doesn't become fully independent. It actually shifts from being a Spanish colony to becoming a U.S. neo-colony of sorts. The U.S. officially occupies Cuba for 5 years or so between 1898 and 1902, and then through a constitutional amendment called the Platt Amendment, an amendment to the Constitution of Cuba, the U.S. reserves the right to intervene in Cuba. Out of that amendment, the Platt Amendment, the U.S. gets a possession in Cuba that it still has, the possession of Guantanamo, right?
Right.
Similarly, Puerto Rico doesn't really become independent after it becomes independent from Spain. It becomes a U.S. territory.
But how did that happen? How did the U.S. get it from Spain?
Through its involvement in the war. There's a war known to Cubans as the War of Cuban Independence. The war is known to American citizens as the U.S.-Spanish War. As a result of the war, Spain is forced to grant independence to Cuba and Puerto Rico, but it's an independence that doesn't lead to the creation of fully independent republics in Cuba and Puerto Rico, but they become possessions of the U.S.
So given all of this history, and when you look at how each island nation has responded to or not responded to these major hurricanes, who do you think ended up in the best situation out of all of this colonization and this troubling history in the Caribbean?
It can be hard to tell. It's easy to say that it is better to be independent than to be dependent on a foreign power.
Although right now, actually, if you look at an independent nation like Dominica, they're probably in worse shape than a nation that has some help from its colonial power.
That is part of what makes this a difficult answer because it is actually not clear. And you can see that it's not clear in places like the French overseas territories of Guadeloupe and Martinique, where despite the existence of a pro-independence movement, it is clear that the population doesn't want to to become an independent country. Something very similar happens in Puerto Rico, right? Puerto Ricans are American citizens without direct representation in Congress. And although there exists a pro-independence movement in Puerto Rico, it has never reached the sufficient strength to actually push for independence, right? On the other hand, as we are seeing now with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico is not the owner of its own destiny in terms of acting to help itself, right? Mm. Puerto Rico does not have a government that can make decisions about how to approach this crisis.
So one of the ways that a number of these Caribbean islands are going to work their way out of this crisis and the aftermath of the hurricanes is that they're going to rely, as they have, on tourism. How did we get to the point where almost every economy in the Caribbean is totally reliant on tourism?
The story of tourism as the main economic activity in the Caribbean is a 20th century story. It's a history that has a lot to do with sunbathing, of tanning. That became a fashion of sorts in the 1920s or 1930s. So that's the moment where, not just in the Caribbean, but sort of globally, the idea of beaches as a destination for tourists becomes a thing.
And do you expect anything to change after all these hurricanes when it comes to the economies of the Caribbean, or will they just go right back to tourism?
I think it would be hard for the economies of the Caribbean, for the Caribbean islands, to move away from tourism. But at the same time, tourism, like any other economic activity that is heavily dependent on external demand, it's a very risky activity, because I can imagine many tourists thinking it twice before deciding to go on their dream Caribbean vacation, right? It's another one of those moments in the Caribbean where its future may not be in its own hands.
That's Ernesto Bassi, who is an assistant professor of history at Cornell University, joining us on Skype to talk about the history of the Caribbean. Ernesto, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
According to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 121 people kill themselves every day in the U.S. Firearms account for almost 50% of those deaths, and this is a big concern in Vermont. Vermont Public Radio recently completed an analysis of the 420 gun deaths that took place in that state over a six-year period. Their reporting shows that nearly 90% of deaths by firearm in Vermont are suicides. VPR's Liam Elder Connors looks at how state public health officials are trying to prevent them.
Between January 2011 and December 2016, 89% of gun deaths in Vermont were suicides. That doesn't surprise Thomas Delaney.
No, not at all.
Delaney's an assistant professor at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine. He studies suicide prevention.
We know that Vermont has historically pretty low homicide rates, but suicide rates have tended to be much higher than national averages.
When you look at data like this, you know, what are you thinking about?
Well, I tend to think about prevention. So what should we be doing that we aren't doing?
A big part of suicide prevention is to keep a person who's in a crisis safe during that time, connecting them to mental health services and removing lethal means, like guns, from their environment. Delaney says the idea that a person will just find another way to kill themselves is not true.
So most of the people, and we know this from a few studies now, most of the people who survive even really serious attempts at taking their lives actually don't go on to die by suicide.
And because the suicidal crisis is often brief, Delaney says it's important to get that person away from guns fast.
Firearms not really reversible. Once you make that decision, there's no opportunity to then go back, call 911 or call your counselor or whatever.
And all the time we're saying, this isn't about gun rights, this is about safety.
Charlotte McCorkle's with Howard Center, a nonprofit community mental health organization based in Burlington, Vermont. And full disclosure, the center is an underwriter for Vermont Public Radio. McCorkle talks about promoting safe access to guns, not reducing access, because access to guns can often become a political issue. But safety is something that people can agree on, regardless of politics.
We don't want to offend the gun-owning community. We want to join with them, because certainly no one wants a suicide death by firearm or by any means.
Promoting safe access to guns can take different forms. It might mean that someone gives their gun to a friend or family member if they're going through a tough time, or it could mean ensuring a gun is unloaded and locked away. McCorkle says Howard Center clinicians carry gun locks to give away, and the center also has free lock boxes for storing guns, and those go fast.
I believe over the past 4 years, we've given away more than 300.
But McCorkle says what's really important is that everyone, doctors, mental health workers, state officials, and gun owners, work together to talk about suicide prevention and gun safety. And one such program is called the Gun Shop Project, and it's a collaboration between the state, suicide prevention groups, and the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen Clubs and the Gun Owners of Vermont. Both of those groups are Second Amendment advocacy groups. And the project aims to raise awareness about suicide prevention by distributing fact sheets to gun shop owners and posters that they can hang up in their shops. The Big Dog in Cregan's gun shop is almost too big for the compact store in downtown Rutland, Vermont. Two glass cases of handguns make up the counter and rifles line the wall. John Cregan, the owner, says that his shop serves mostly hunters, which makes sense given some of the taxidermy on the wall.
I see one, two, three, four deer, and five, six, okay, six deer, two bears, and a buffalo head. Are all those...
Cregan says preventing suicide is tricky. He's not a trained professional, but he says he can choose who to sell guns to.
I had a lady come in one time and said, I need a gun. I said, what do you want? She said, just something that'll do the job. And I don't know if she was going to go shoot someone or if she was going to commit suicide. I don't know. But she didn't leave here with a gun. You know, I have to sleep at night. I live in this community. I raise my son in this community.
And suicide isn't an abstract issue for Cregan.
So I've had two very good friends of mine do it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they use guns?
Both of them. And that's, you know, that makes it harder for me because we're around them all the time. But that was their choice. And, you know, it is what it is.
Cregan says he got some information about the gun shop project from the state, though he didn't have any of the posters up.
How did you find that material useful?
There were some suggestions in there, which we basically follow anyways. Again, if somebody's in here and they're just doom and gloom, you know, and if nothing else, we can stall them for a little while, give them a day or two and see. But I would just soon not sell the gun, if there's any doubt at all.
Having these conversations about suicide is difficult. But McCorkle at Howard Center says it's important to find ways to bring these conversations about suicide prevention and gun safety into the open, and for people to hear that message, and not only from public health officials.
It's important to have role models giving the message who are part of the NRA or who are gun shop owners or in law enforcement who can say, I'm part of this community and this is my practice and this is why it's important.
McCorkle says hopefully these discussions will help someone see alternatives where they might not have seen any before. For Here and Now, I'm Liam Elder Connors.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.